Good morning. Please be seated. It is a great pleasure for Judge Dwyer and I to be on the panel this morning with our newest member of the bench. Judge Mann has been a delight to have added and brings with us a great experience from the environmental law bar, so familiarity with local government issues, land use issues, the trial court. And he's been known to stand out there and take abuse from this court a time or two. So on behalf of the court, welcome. It's great to have you with us. Thank you. Now, the pleasantries are over, so for the unpleasantries, counsel. At least for you, we enjoy the heck out of this.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Jeffrey Ellis. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Bosra, ready to take my share of the abuse this morning. This is a personal restraint petition, and I want to focus my...
And rebuttal time?
I'm going to live dangerously, hopefully find a breaking point with some rebuttal time left on that clock, but let's see where the time takes us. I want to focus my comments primarily today on the constructive denial of the right to testify, and specifically whether we've made a sufficient showing to merit an evidentiary hearing. In this case, Mr. Bosra's declaration says that his attorneys told him that it was his choice whether to testify, but that the lawyers get to decide what questions to ask, which may be a snappy answer in a law school ethics class, but is a disaster as far as trial strategy is concerned. And in fact, Mr. Bosra, when he did take the stand, was really only asked a series of questions about a largely collateral matter.
Well, you refer to it as the constructive denial to the right to testify. So we're all in agreement that he testified.
He did.
He has a right to testify,
sure.
And he testified. So how does a trial court avoid this error that you see? How does the trial court put on the record, so we can be comfortable with it, the thoughts of the attorney and the thoughts of the client with regard to the extent that the client wanted to testify and the conversations between the two of them that led the attorney to override his client's desires? How do we do that and still give meaning to all those other Sixth Amendment concerns?
Sure. Well, obviously, I'm much more interested in correcting the error now that it's passed.
Well, I'm much more interested in actually, let's have justice in the trial court at the beginning, right? I mean, if you're saying this is an injustice, let's find a way to do away with this injustice at its inception, because we can have the best appellate courts in the world, but if we don't have justice in the trial courts, we don't have justice, right?
I agree, and I wasn't intending to sidestep the question. But I think the case law has said that this is a very tricky predicament. I mean, let's just talk about the complete denial of the right to testify. One suggestion that has been made is maybe the trial court should engage in some sort of colloquy with the defendant to determine whether the defendant's silence when he or she chooses not to testify is in fact indicative of that. And the court, which would be obviously be a very prophylactic rule, right?
But here he did testify. So the questioning is, why didn't you testify more?
Well,
Mr. Bosra, why didn't you tell us whether or not you killed your wife?
Sure, sure. And you know, there is that comment from the judge when defense counsel says, after asking about the turban, about, you know, a minute mm-hmm. into the testimony, and it says, that's all the questions we have for the witness, the trial judge stops and then says, what did you say? Mm-hmm. And it's hard to know what the inflection was from that, but to the way I read it suggested, really, that's all there is? A defendant in a murder case is going to take the stand and testify only about a collateral matter? So I think the inquiry could happen at that point.
Why isn't this just viewed under the guise of the other Sixth Amendment right, the right to counsel? Why isn't this just a question of whether or not counsel was effective in its questioning?
Well, because the defendant's right to testify is both a fundamental right and a personal right.
But we've established that he did testify. We're only talking about what questions he was asked.
Right. But I would argue that when counsel, at least in this situation, asks only a series of questions about a largely collateral matter, and where there is evidence now in the record that says the defendant wanted to testify essentially about...
Well, I'm not concerned about the evidence now. We're trying to avoid this error at the beginning.
Right.
We're trying to make this a fair trial at the inception. So what's the trial judge supposed to do to find out that information that's now in Mr. Bosser's affidavit?
I think whenever the scope of a criminal defendant's testimony, right, and that's the only testimony we're talking about because that's the only time where it's a personal fundamental right, when it is so constricted that it raises an inference that counsel is somehow interfering with the right to testify, with the full exercise of that right, that the court can inquire. I don't have a problem with that.
Prosecutor in there?
No. Ex parte hearing.
Ex parte hearing. Not open to the press or the public?
I think because trial
is ongoing. Does that meet the standards for a court closure?
Well, trial is ongoing at this point, right?
Right.
What we're trying to make the determination at this point is, are we going to be in a situation where we're going to return back into court, the defendant will be back up on the stand, and additional questions will be asked.
Well, right, but I mean, the trial court's got to worry about, okay, does the public have an interest in this inquiry? Seems they would.
I totally agree that a bone club hearing would need to be conducted. But it also seems to me that there's interference with the right to a fair trial, because this is an ongoing matter, and now all of a sudden we're discussing trial strategy, and it potentially interferes with the right to counsel. So I would argue that it needs to be a closed hearing after a bone club hearing, at least initially it's ex parte. If there is some contest, for instance, about whether the claim is legitimate, I suppose there could be other evidence. But when it happens contemporaneously, I think you solve the problem that exists post hoc, which is, looking back, the courts have been concerned that this issue is perhaps too easy to be raised after the fact, at least in the case where there's a complete denial of the right to testify.
With a record made?
With a record made.
Sealed forever?
Not necessarily. Certainly.
What if the lawyer's explanation is, he told me he slaughtered her?
Well,
I'm unwilling to put on perjured testimony.
There are multiple ramifications that could come out of this.
Right.
One of which could be the trilemma about what does a defense attorney do when there's some perjury about to happen. And that could result in a variety of remedies, which could include new counsel and a mistrial. But those, I agree. If the court is going in the direction of it's better to solve these problems in the first instance than to deal with them years later, I completely agree. That way we could determine exactly what's going on. This case at least raises the specter of something is happening when a defendant says, I'm going to testify, and then gets asked only a question about a collateral matter. And then when counsel objects, when the prosecutor tries to go into the obvious material matter, which is, did you kill your wife and why? And there are objections to that, which is itself its own kind of prejudice in terms of being harmful to the defendant. But let me get back to why I think an evidentiary hearing is required in this case. The state makes a lot out of Robinson, which is a direct appeal case. But Lord, which is a personal restraint petition, still holds, and it was cited with approval in Robinson, that an evidentiary hearing is required if the defendant alleges that his attorney actually prevented him from testifying on his own behalf. It doesn't require a showing of anything beyond that allegation, which has been made in this case, that there was a constructive denial. And with regard to the
issue, that's an easier inquiry when the only issue is he didn't in fact testify at all, and it's a question of counsel, did you prevent him from testifying?
Well, the courts are concerned in cases where there's no testimony from the defendant, where the defendant simply remains silent at trial and then after trial says, I wanted to testify. The courts are concerned that it's simply too easy to raise that claim. A defendant can do it any time he chooses not to testify and gets convicted and says, I wanted to and my attorney prevented me. And the courts have imposed a slightly higher bar in those cases in order to get an evidentiary hearing. But again, I would suggest in this case, the simple unusual nature of the testimony given suggests that there's something going on. And then when you add to that Mr. Bosra's clear declaration that says, I wanted to tell them everything, that simply is sufficient to get to an evidentiary hearing. Likewise, it's sufficient for prejudice.
Doesn't that invite us to have a similar hearing on every question that is asked at the insistence of, if he testifies? Then counsel goes, well, wait, I wanted to testify, but I didn't want him to ask that question.
I don't think the dive is that deep. I mean, there is a certain amount of control that defense counsel has over the ordering of the examination and even the subjects to go into. This is the easy case, I would suggest, where the scope of the examination is so limited and where the desire to testify is so broad and obviously would seem to fit with at least the presumptions of the jurors that if the defendant is going to get on the stand and testify, he's going to testify to relevant things, not somehow hide behind objections made after the fact and only get on the stand, put his credibility in issue on.
So was counsel ineffective for objecting to the question, did you kill your wife?
Counsel's objection was part and parcel of the interference in the constructive denial of the right to testify.
So he should not have objected?
Not from Mr. Boswell's point of view.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You did find the interesting issue. Counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court. Amy Meckling, King County Deputy Prosecutor on behalf of the respondent in this matter. In response to Judge Dwyer's question about what exactly the trial court can do to sort of forestall this from happening in the first instance, Mr. Ellis responded with his proposal was if there is the testimony has been so restricted that it, quote, raises an inference that counsel has therefore denied his client the right to testify, then there should be this ex parte or out of the presence of the prosecutor in the public hearing. That's not what we have here. There was no inference that counsel had interfered with his client's right to testify other than the fact that the questioning was limited. But there's no evidence whatsoever other than Mr. Basra's, after the guilty verdict, self-serving declaration that he wanted or desired to testify more fully at the time. And that affidavit you should view with considerable skepticism given the posture in which it was raised. What we know about Mr. Basra is that he had no difficulty speaking up when he was dissatisfied with his attorneys and what was happening in court. There's several instances in the trial record where that happened, and I would note that he was on his fourth set of attorneys. He had no problems speaking up for himself when he was unhappy with what his counsel was doing. He did not speak up and say, hey, wait a second, why are you only asking me these few questions? In fact, the questions that were asked of him were questions that Mr. Ellis describes as collateral, and I would say that's generous. These are questions that were seemingly irrelevant in the grand scheme of things, but clearly mattered to Mr. Basra. He wrote a letter to the court asking about how can the police officer's testimony even be admitted when it's if they're saying that my turban was orange and it was really maroon or brown, how can we rely on their testimony at all? He was very concerned about this issue with the turban. I don't think these are questions that his attorneys would have thought to ask him or found particularly relevant to ask him without some input from Mr. Basra. I think that you start with the presumption that counsel is competent. You don't start with the presumption that counsel, an experienced counsel in a first-degree murder case, is going to deny their client the right to testify when he has said, I want to testify fully, and then they purposely say to him, well, we get to ask the questions, and we're only going to ask you these
questions.
Well, but
doesn't the rule exist, the rule allowing a defendant to testify, doesn't it in part exist to keep competent counsel from substituting counsel's judgment for the judgment of the client?
Yes, I would agree with that. And I think that the inference, I suppose, that Mr. Ellis and Mr. Bosworth are asking you to draw from the record here is that this was something that counsel decided to do over Mr. Bosworth's objection. But I think that a more reasonable inference, given the case, I mean, keep in mind that Mr. Bosworth's version of the crime, of the murder, was already in front of the jury through both the state's expert and the defense expert, because they both interviewed him about the facts of the crime. He told them his memories of it, which was consistent, with both of them, and then they both imparted that information to the jury. So Mr. Basra's version of the homicide is already in front of the jury. I think that it is a much more plausible explanation of what happened, is that Mr. Basra's attorneys told him, it's your right to testify. They said that on the record. They made it clear that it was his right, and they knew that, and they had told him that. It is your right to testify. Given these circumstances, it's probably not in your best interest to subject yourself to cross-examination. But we know that Mr. Basra, who is concerned about this issue with the turban and really wanted to talk about it, perhaps said, I really want to talk about this turban, and perhaps, this is a reasonable inference, his attorney says, fine, we can ask you about that alone, and we can try to shut down the prosecutor cross-examining you about anything else. And Mr. Basra could have easily agreed with that at the time. And now,
so you're
after the verdict.
So you're arguing inferences. Does that militate in favor, then, of a reference hearing?
No. I think that what we have is we have a petitioner who is required to produce, and I'll read the language so that I make sure to get it correct. He's not entitled to an evidentiary hearing based solely on his own declaration, contrary to what he says. He must present substantial factual evidence, and he must be able to demonstrate from the record that his specific factual allegations are credible. So what I'm proposing to you is that he has not done that, because the inference that I'm asking you to draw is a much more credible one. So he hasn't met his burden to prove that the record would support his now version of what he told his attorneys. And I would like to point out, and unless the court has any more questions about the deficient performance prong of Strickland, because you do analyze this under Strickland, I would like to point out that the defendant has a burden, petitioner has a burden, as to both the prejudice prong as well as the deficient performance prong. And if there's a failure of proof as to either, then his Strickland claim fails. He has presented nothing, absolutely nothing, with respect to prejudice. Robinson tells us that he has to show how his proposed testimony, in other words, what his proposed testimony is, and how that would have effectuated a reasonable probability of effectuating a different outcome. He hasn't even attempted to do that. He has said, well, you just need to remand for a determination of prejudice and let him testify, and then we can decide from there. But under Robinson and under Rice, which more generally applies to personal restraint petitions, an evidentiary hearing is not to determine whether or not the defendant has been prejudiced in the sense that he has factual evidence to back it up. It's to determine whether there's a dispute about the facts, and to determine what that dispute and to resolve that. It's not to determine whether he has evidence to support that. So this court, even if you agreed, and I don't think you should do this, but even if you were to agree that Mr. Basra told his attorneys, I would like to testify much more broadly than this, and they did not allow him to do that, even if that had been shown, he hasn't demonstrated how that has prejudiced him, and for that reason his claim fails, and he's not entitled to a reference hearing.
What's the nature of the prejudice he has to show? If it was established, if he had not testified at all, and the declaration from his trial counsel was, yeah, he told me he wanted to testify, and I just told him that'd be nuts, so we didn't call him. You're saying he wouldn't be entitled to a reference hearing, or he'd be entitled to a reference hearing, but he wouldn't be entitled to relief.
No, I think that what his burden is, and this, unlike Robinson, where the court remanded it for a reference hearing when they were on prejudice, when there hadn't really been any talk about that in the personal restraint petition, they did that because it wasn't clear to the court whether he had had the opportunity to present evidence as to prejudice below. So that, because he hadn't had that opportunity necessarily, they wanted to give him that opportunity. Mr. Basra had that opportunity when he filed his personal restraint petition. He could have said, here is what my proposed testimony was, and then he could have shown how in the context of the evidence that testimony had a reasonable probability of altering the outcome here. He didn't even make an effort to do that. And we already know what his proposed testimony would likely have been, because that came in through the experts. If he had testified to something different, that would have severely undermined his chances. If he had testified to the same version that he'd already told the two experts, that would have added very little to his cause. So he hasn't been able to, it's not that you remand for that showing what the proposed testimony would be. I think that it's incumbent upon a personal restraint petitioner to outline for the court in his personal restraint petition what that testimony is and how that would have changed the outcome in the case. and he hasn't done that here. So unless the court has any other questions, I will forego the last 1 minute and a half of my time and ask this court to find that he has not met his burden in a personal restraint petition to even warrant a factual hearing, and this court should dismiss the petition.
Thank you, counsel. The second matter this morning would be in re the support of DR.